So maybe you could develop the connection there as part of the practice.
Okay, to try and summarize this idea again of taking death, intermediate state, and rebirth into the path. So the path is what we do when we're practicing. That's what we do when we sit down and meditate. The path, in a sense, is what we do when we make decisions on a moment-by-moment basis about how we're going to act, rather than just being driven by impulse. When we self-consciously are standing in line, this is my favorite example, when we're self-consciously standing in line at checking out in Safeway, and you look at the checker and you think, oh, this poor lady has been on her feet for 8 hours dealing with people like me. Can I say something to make her life a little lighter and better, rather than being my usual grouchy self going through the checkout line kind of thing? That's a conscious decision to do something of a positive and beneficial nature. So that these are path practices. And in a certain sense, the path is just life. The path is just living, but it's living with self-consciousness and intention of a certain kind. Okay? Living with self-consciousness and intention of a certain kind. And it isn't even what you might consider spiritual. It's like being nice to other people and cleaning up your messes, rather than, you know, being a burden on other people. But it's a matter of self-consciousness and intentionality for transformation. When Kay and I were in Dharamsala in the early 90s, I've mentioned this a few times, we were living at a monastery there, at the guest house of a monastery there. And one of the encounters that I had that had such an impact on me was with one of the senior monks at this monastery, at Namgyal Monastery. And when I met with him, he said, remember that the whole of the Buddhist path is converting negative minds into positive minds. That's it. I mean, only a spiritual genius could go like, there it is. You know, that's the whole path. And because he was so accomplished, I couldn't do anything but believe him. I was like, okay, that must be what it is. I mean, here's the senior practitioner in the Dalai Lama's monastery. It's going to be believable. Converting negative minds, or as we would say, negative states of mind, into positive states of mind. That's the path. So being nice to the checkout people in Safeway is the path. Cleaning up the dishes rather than leaving them for your wife. That's the path. You know, it doesn't matter. Whatever it is, that is a self-conscious, intentional improving of your relations with the world and other people and yourself. That's the path. Okay, that's sort of a simple way to describe it. But it is still all about transforming the mind, right? It's sort of like when I'm in the kitchen, rather than being a lazy slob and just going to bed and saying, "Kay can do the dishes later tonight," it's sort of like saying, no, this is my turn. Fair and square is I take my responsibility to maintain the scene in this house, right? Irrespective of the little kid in me who's spoiled and says, I don't want to do the dishes, you know, let mommy do the dishes, I'm out of here, right? Okay. But the deepest sense of the path is, what is that mind which needs to be transformed? What is the mind that needs to be transformed? So here I want to draw a distinction. I want to define what I mean by mind. The mind to be transformed is not the consciousness which is to be transformed. I want to draw a distinction between mind and consciousness. And that's the distinction that I'll use from here on out, which is, consciousness is just awareness. It's just our awareness of what's happening. But our awareness of what's happening is mediated by the mental operations, the cognitive operations that are going on in our head. The fact that we symbolize everything, that we generate ideas about things, that we draw conclusions about things, that we have habitual patterns of understanding things, that we have linguistic patterns which control the way we think about things and understand things. All that complex of emotions, habits, rational activity and whatnot, that's the mind. Now, there are more technical ways of describing the mind in Buddhist thought, but I'll just sort of leave it at that for the moment, to draw the distinction between the sort of the churning cognitive process and the fact of awareness. Okay, so the fact of awareness and the churning cognitive process come together, but in the Buddhist tradition, it's understood you can separate them from each other, so that you can stand back from that cognitive process and see it, watch it, with simple awareness. And you can also experience the world through the sense organs with simple awareness, unmediated by all that cognition. So it's a whole other question of why you'd want to do that, I suppose, but for the moment I just want to draw that distinction between those two. The path, taking death, intermediate state, and rebirth into the path, which is sort of the foundational understanding in Tantra or Vajrayana, the path then is about cultivating the mind to reveal something about the nature of consciousness. It's not about cultivating consciousness, although a different kind of consciousness is the goal. So what does that mean? Awareness is just awareness from the Buddhist point of view. Awareness is just awareness. It doesn't change, except that our awareness is usually mediated by our thought processes. And because it's mediated by our thought processes, we don't have awareness of what's going on as it would actually present itself to us. We have awareness of what's going on as we construe it based upon our own habits. Okay? So if I'm driving down the street and I need a pair of shoes, I see shoe stores in a way in which I would otherwise ignore them when I don't need shoes, right? Because I have a need for something which is controlling my attention. And so suddenly, wow, I'm in a town full of shoe stores that I never noticed before because I need shoes, right? When I'm hungry, I'm not in a town full of shoe stores, I'm in a town full of restaurants, okay? That's what I mean. So my awareness is shaped, mediated, directed by needs, desires, and the way I think about things, right? if I'm, I'm going to look at a semi, I'm going to try and find a semi-neutral notion about the way my mental attitudes control what I think about. No, I'm not going to be able to find one, so we'll pass on that, but okay. I think you had the idea. So, taking death, intermediate state, and rebirth into the path, taking death into the path is using the possibility of unmediated consciousness as part of spiritual practice. And I say using the possibility because we don't know really how to be in that state right now, but it is possible. We can seek it. We can try to get into it. That can be a goal. And we can't actually achieve it. I mean, I've been there for about a nanosecond once in a while. It's not easy to achieve, and it's more difficult to hold on to. But the truth of the matter is, if you get a glimpse of it, it's very powerful, because you get a glimpse of it, and then you think, oh, that's what that is. That's a good. I like that. Okay, how do I get more of that one? You know, it's a powerful motivator. Taking the in-between into the path, which is like taking dreams into the path, as we've talked about, that's sort of like if you pay more attention to the internal stuff that's going on and sort of bracket or set aside all the external stuff for a while, and sort of notice that and try and work with that and kind of be with that, then kind of what happens when that's the case. We were talking earlier about when your mind is, when the world is complicated and giving you a lot to do and distressing you in many ways, your mind is reactive. And you see that going on. If you can get into a place where you just sort of say, let's just not pay attention to how bright it is outside and the car noise that's going on, and is my body comfortable, and I'm just going to notice what's going on in my mind. That's like getting into that space of dream, because you start noticing that you're constantly constructing stories about reality. You think you're being rational on a moment-by-moment basis, but you notice that what's actually happening, if you're sitting and meditating and sort of set aside the external world, what you notice is really going on is you're constructing all kinds of mental dramas about things. It's like, this is what I'm going to have to do at work. This is what I'm going to need to, how am I going to deal with the fact that I've got property taxes to pay, I have two different plumbers to pay at the end of the month, I've only got so much money, and by the way, we've got this other bill on this, that, and the other thing, and the bills are this much, and the income is half this much, and what do I put off till next month? Oh, that's right, I have to pay Visa too. And you're sitting there and all this kind of stuff is going on, and you're constructing an internal drama of how to deal with it, right? So you notice that that's what's going on. Well, that internal drama is no different than the dramas that you have when you're dreaming, except that when you're dreaming, the dramas are more fluid, right? When you're dreaming, and the dramas are more symbolic, right? So you could be thinking about how you're going to pay the Visa bill, and that night when you fall asleep, you're being chased by some monster. It's the Visa monster that's chasing you, but you don't recognize it as the Visa monster, right? But it is. It happens to me all the time. So that's taking the dream state or the in-between state into the path, which is working with those dramas, working with the fact that this kind of internal process is running us and is sort of in control of and controlling or directing our awareness. I'm not being all that clear about it, I don't think. But then the rebirth state, as you know, we would take death in between and rebirth. The rebirth state is really, it's more a matter of coming into rational consciousness. And that's like, you know, in a sense, when I'm thinking about paying the Visa bill, there is a sort of rational element to what's happening. And I could actually sit down and I could sort of, you know, mark down all the various bills that I have. I could, you know, do this on various columns. These are all the bills that I have. This is the income that I have. This is how much it's going to take, how much time it's going to take to pay off the bill if this month I pay this much and that month I pay this much, and then I know I'm not going to have another property tax bill for the next 4 months, so I can pay a quarter of the property tax bill next month and a quarter of the property tax bill, you know. And you kind of lay that stuff out kind of in a very rational way. That's like the rebirth state of mind. Although in Buddhism, it's more like the analytical mind that looks at what's actually going on in the world and tries to understand it rationally. Tries to rationally understand, what do I misunderstand typically? Tries to rationally, analytically understand, what are the sources of my own confusion? You know, how does the cognitive process work? These kinds of things. So that's maybe not the best example to bring to bear on the idea of rationality. But the main point is, what the Buddhist path tries to do is to use all these different states of mind, or conditions of mind, dreaming state, the rational state, the unitary state. It uses them all together to change the mind, to transform the mind, to transform negative habits into positive habits. And why would you transform negative habits into positive habits? Well, for one thing, positive habits have better outcomes in the world. You make other people happy, they make you happy. Make other people miserable, they're going to come around and make you miserable. There's no doubt about that. You exploit the world's going to come back and have something to say about it, as we fully well know, and so on and so forth. So at that level, a positive state of mind is better than a negative state of mind in terms of its outcomes. But the other thing is, positive states of mind, at least according to the Dalai Lama, positive states of mind are more congruent with reality. They're more congruent with reality. And they more fully reveal the actual underlying characteristic of awareness. Now, so what does that mean? If you're in an iron cage or a golden cage, you're still in a cage, right? So we could say that a negative state of mind is an iron cage and a positive state of mind is a golden cage. in the end, you'd say, so what difference does it make? You're still in a cage. But the difference is that if you're in an iron cage, if you have a negative state of mind, you're not just dealing with the fact that you're in a cage, you're dealing with the fact of the unhappiness of being in a cage. And if you have a positive state of mind, you're not just, you're happier about being in a cage. Now this is, okay, this is not making much sense. Let me try it this way. One of our teachers said, life is struggle. There's no way to get around the fact that life is struggle. But the problem is that we struggle with struggling and we make the struggle worse. I mean, life is tough. There's a lot of stuff you have to do to get on with life. And you can either just like do it and not complain about it and not worry about it, or you can do it and you can kvetch all the time and make everything a whole lot worse for yourself. Okay. So all that other stuff of making things worse for yourself is like the iron cage. And just getting on with it and not worrying about it is like the golden cage. That was a terrible example. But that it were, all right, well, okay. I mean, the reason where this came from is I was meditating this morning and I was thinking to myself, you know, my life would be better if I did X. My life would be better if I did Y. I mean, my life's going through a lot of big transitions right now, as many of you know. So if only I could do this, everything would be okay. You know, if I had more money, everything would be okay. If I lived here, everything would be okay. If my back didn't bother me, everything would be okay. Whatever it is, everything would be okay. And then it occurred to me, we have this friend, very dear friend, who's quite wealthy, and she's always kvetching too. And there's like, what's wrong with her life? And I look at her life, and she lives in this splendid house in Atherton. It's beautiful. The weather is perfect. She has plenty of money. She has a wonderful family around her. And what's happened? Well, what's happened is her wonderful husband is so old now that he can't really manage the family business, which has made them wealthy. So she has to take over managing the family business, which she doesn't really want to do. And I'm thinking, oh, poor soul. She has to take over the family business to make another couple million dollars this year, you know? Well, yeah, it's really hard on her. She really doesn't want to do it. That's her golden cage. And I thought, you know what, David, it wouldn't make any difference. If you had that other job, you would be miserable, as miserable as you are if you didn't have that other job. That's not the issue. The issue is, what are you going to do with your mind to make your mind leave you alone so you'll stop being miserable? It has nothing to do with what's going on the outside, right? If you were running your friend's business, you'd go crazy. I mean, you like having the money, but you know, you'd be drinking half a bottle of whiskey every night to deal with the stress. This would just not work for you. So what do you know? So that's where the golden cage, iron cage thing came from today. It's like, she's in a golden cage and it's much better than the iron cage, but we're both still in a cage because we're both controlled by our minds. So how do we get free of that? How do we get free of our expectations? That's really what it was all about. And just be, and be happy to be, and not worry about all the rest of that stuff.
Okay.
Well, you asked for it.